From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you the highlights from 2019. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. On March 16th's edition of Press Conference USA, we had our first in a series of conversations with members of Congress. Our guest then was Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, who represents Virginia's 7th Congressional District. 2019 marked the 70th anniversary of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or as it's more commonly known, NATO. Representative Spanberger comments on whether or not the U.S. is doing enough to strengthen the NATO alliance.
I think that we are definitely not doing enough to recognize and assert the value of NATO. I think that some of the rhetoric that's come out of the executive branch has done just the opposite of that, has maybe shaken the foundation of trust that exists between the United States and our NATO allies. And I do think that members of Congress, particularly the Foreign Affairs Committee and all of Congress as a whole in passing this resolution, have taken steps to affirm our position that NATO is incredibly vital to our long-term national security and that the relationships under NATO are incredibly important to us. But I do have really significant concerns about a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the White House related to NATO.
And to what extent do you think this rhetoric and these actions, in a sense, play into one of our most formidable foreign adversaries' hands, and that is Russia's Vladimir Putin's hands, and therefore, in a sense, endanger our collective national security? As a follow-up, do you think we're doing enough to combat Vladimir Putin's Russia, which is an autocratic regime, which interfered in our elections, which interferes in many other elections around the world, particularly in Europe, to the detriment of mainstream center-left or center-right parties, and often bolsters far-right parties and populist parties?
It's troubling and unsurprising to see how harmful Russia's influence has been. We've seen Russia aggress against the United States in our 2016 elections. Moving into the future, we have to recognize, we being the international community, but particularly the United States, have to recognize the overall threat that Russia's propaganda or instability efforts have on this country and on our relationships across the world. I think that there's perhaps in recent years never been a time where we've needed our NATO allies more, particularly given the aggressive nature, the aggressive posturing that Russia has made against the United States and with allegations of meddling, be it in England, be it in France, be it in other elections. I think it's incredibly important that we affirm the relationships that we do have under NATO, that we engage in information sharing wherever possible to be sure that we can address these concerns. One of the things that the House passed last week, we passed H.R. 1, which is a campaign finance reform and good governance bill. But in that bill, there were multiple amendments meant to address foreign money flowing to our elections, the ability of foreign nations, foreign actors, foreign companies to purchase ads on social media, as we know Russian entities did in the 2016 and 2018 elections. I offered an amendment that would require the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, to provide threat assessments, be it from non-state actors, state actors, or just overall cyber weaknesses that may exist with our voting machines, to the individual states so the states can address any concerns and ideally safeguard and protect our elections. So there's a variety of things that we in Congress are trying to do to get at the threats that we see coming from Russia. Certainly there's investigations in the Intelligence Committee that's working to better understand what's happened and what continues to happen. But I think that all of it just points to the fact that it's incredibly important that we keep and affirm our strong relationships with our NATO allies.
Representative Spanberger, a Democrat, won her seat in Congress by defeating a Republican incumbent in the November 2018 elections. She considers herself a centrist and often works with her Republican colleagues to create and pass bipartisan legislation. Congresswoman Spanberger shares her political philosophy and tells us why it's important for Democrats and Republicans to work together for the common good of all Americans.
I'm a Democrat. I've always been a Democrat because I believe that the core values of the Democratic Party is that we can use legislation and policy to foundationally better people's lives, to create more opportunity, to create a more vibrant and rich country in a way that people can prosper. And we do that through policies that are fair and encourage growth and prioritize education and recognize that sometimes people need a boost if they've fallen on hard times. And so I somewhat reject these notions of always having to label where we fall on the spectrum, because, you know, I think it is a moving target. And I think that if we want to create legislation that is long-lasting and impactful, we have to find places where we can agree. And I think a good example is the bipartisan background check bill that we just passed 2 weeks ago. And that bill, it was bipartisan. Republicans and Democrats came together, voted for it. And it is the largest piece and most impactful piece of gun violence prevention legislation that we've had in more than 20 years. I think on issues like prescription drugs and stabilizing Medicare, that's a great area where we can have bipartisan agreement, because at the end of the day, you know, these are issues that impact everyone, regardless of your political ideology, infrastructure issues. We all benefit. We might disagree on how to go about prioritizing infrastructure issues, but when we have bridges and roads that work and broadband internet that connects our communities, that is going to positively impact, you know, the broad spectrum of Americans. And so I think discussing some of these issues where we can come together and then work our way towards an actual legislative next step, that's what I'm trying to do. That's where I'm trying to find some common ground. And I think it's necessary so that we get out of this volleying back and forth between Democrats are in charge and we do this, and then Republicans are in charge and they undo it and then do something else, and then flipping back and forth. It's not sustainable.
In May, on our next visit to Capitol Hill, Carol spoke with Congressman John Curtis, a Republican who represents Utah's 3rd Congressional District. Nearly 60% of Utah's lands are managed by the federal government. Representative Curtis's district is also home to some of the most iconic and scenic places in the United States. And as a result, he serves on the House Natural Resources Committee. The congressman told us what he is doing to ensure that these lands are protected.
Well, I love the question because it is a big part of what I do. I have Bears Ears in my district, which a lot of people have heard about because of President Obama's original Antiquities Act designation, and President Trump repealed that. But what people don't know a lot about is Emery County, which is near Bears Ears. And we just finished a bill, made it all the way through the House. The Senate was signed into law. That's 1 million acres of conservation, recreation, grazing. And we actually brought these groups together who rarely agree on these difficult public lands issues. And we're able to get a bill through, a substantial bill. And I think that gives us hope that we can duplicate that formula in some of my other counties. And this team and my office spends a tremendous amount of time on these public lands issues.
On that particular topic, it seems like the Trump administration, Mr. Trump in particular, would prefer to develop some of these areas and actually risk jeopardizing their protected status.
So that's really not true. I think what you're seeing from President Trump is more a leaning towards letting these decisions be made locally. And I feel like the people locally want to preserve and protect as much as everybody else. It's really not a decision of what we do with these lands. It's more a decision of who gets to make those choices and how they're managed.
In a related topic, let's turn now to the issue of climate change. President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the Paris Accord. What are your thoughts with regard to that?
We just debated this in Congress. We had H.R. 9, which really was on this issue. And the problem with the Paris Peace Accord is fundamentally it gives a pass to China, to Iran, to these countries who are putting out vast amounts of pollution. And then, in my opinion, is discriminately hard on rural America and parts of my district. So my question to those who are pushing the Paris Peace Accord is, why is it okay to give a pass to a human rights violating dictator and then villainize people in rural Utah? And it's not about taking care of this earth. It's not about leaving the earth better than we found it. It's really about the fact that there were some fundamental flaws in that accord that, in my opinion, were detrimentally hard on rural America.
Representative Curtis also serves on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He gives his opinion on President Trump's approach to foreign affairs, and he shares his thoughts on international relations.
It really should surprise no one that the president that was elected to go against the grain is going against the grain, and it's painful. And it causes a lot of us, myself included, some anxiety. But he's delivering really what was promised. And it's kind of one of the things that's interesting about the president. When people complain, I frequently say, there's nothing that you don't know about the president today that you didn't know when he was elected. And so that is his style. And his style is to come in and blow things up and cause a lot of discomfort. And the question is, can things be put back together in a way that is actually better for America than when he started? And, you know, we're all watching very carefully as these things are happening. There are examples, and I'll give one, of our NATO partners not spending the appropriate amount of their budgets on defense. That has been very positive. There's been a really positive change and acknowledgement that they needed to up their game with that. And so I think people are watching to see if this style is effective, if it delivers the types of results that ultimately are good for our country, or if it damages long-term relationships, as you have alluded to.
Let's turn now to immigration, because it sort of sits at the nexus between domestic and foreign policy. And of course, just like President Trump has the America First mantra, you know, he ran also on this anti-immigrant message, not just against illegal immigrants, but even he has restricted legal immigration. And of course, now he's intent on building this so-called border wall, even though Congress has not allocated funding for it. He's taking funds from the military and so on. Do you think that's the best way to go, Congressman Curtis?
You know, I've probably given more thought to immigration than any other topic, which is probably similar to all my colleagues. This is a big issue. And I don't mind telling you, in my short time here in Congress, one of my biggest disappointments is that we have been unable to make progress on this. But I think, to be fair, this problem first and foremost belongs to Congress. The president is only doing these things because Congress is not acting. If we got our stuff together, and if we worked together as Republicans and Democrats, none of what the president did would really be relevant, because we hold the power to solve this problem. And so, first and foremost, I think we need to blame Congress, and I'm a member of Congress as I say that. We need to work together. We need to find solutions, and we're simply not doing it. And I think in many ways we're letting the American people down.
In early June, Carroll visited the U.S. Department of State to talk with Ambassador Sam Brownback, the U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, or IRF. Ambassador Brownback's office monitors religious persecution and discrimination throughout the world. He talks about the state of religious freedom in the world and points out some of the trouble spots where there is widespread mistreatment of people who just want to practice their faith in peace.
There are lists of the worst actors in the world. These are nations that really oppress faith, where it's very dangerous a lot of times for religious adherents or of a minority religion to practice their faith. And the government doesn't step in and protect the individuals. There are places where there's communal violence taking place, but the government's doing everything they can. But in some cases, it's a government that doesn't have the resources, or it's too weak to really be more effective than they are. But these are a series of countries. China's in this group of countries of particular concern. We've got about 11 nations in that category. Some of them are authoritarian regimes. Tajikistan, Turkmenistan are ones that are just really doing a lot of control and not letting people openly practice their faith. In China, you've just got a broad war against people of faith. Pakistan just recently went on the list of countries of particular concern, and it was that the government really wasn't standing up to the people that were conducting all the persecution. It was a lot of communal violence, but the government itself wasn't stepping up, and itself was encouraging some of this by their blasphemy laws and other things.
Ambassador Brownback talked about some of the places throughout the world where religious persecution is harshest. In particular, he spoke of the horrendous discrimination that the Uyghur Muslims are suffering at the hands of the predominantly Han Chinese.
This is a atheistic communist government that's at war with all faiths. They're at war with Islam, with the Uyghurs. They're at war with Buddhism, with the Tibetan Buddhists. They're at war with the Christians. They're at war with Falun Gong. And it's a war they will not win. That's a very counterproductive thing of what China is doing, is that they're at war with faith, but they will not win this war. You will not subjugate faith. Faith will find a way to flourish, just like a plant grows up in a sidewalk. It will find a way to get moving on forward. And the freedom is what should be embraced of it. But currently, the Chinese government has over 1 million Uyghurs in labor camps in the western part of the country. They have destroyed any number of the house churches. The Tibetan Buddhism they've been putting down for years, and Falun Gong, they've had a particularly harsh attitude in criminalizing and imprisoning. And I told you about the one British report of even citing organ harvesting from Falun Gong practitioners. Part of what's also concerning about China is their new methods that they're bringing in place of oppression. It's cameras and artificial intelligence systems and blocking your ability to enter into the stream of commerce or to have an apartment if you go to the mosque and your face is seen, and taking DNA samples from everybody so they can track all of you. And it's this sort of big brother gone wild to oppress and suppress a religion. And then our concern is they're going to start selling the system to the rest of the world, to authoritarian regimes in other places that seek to put down a minority. And once the system is developed and all the software behind it, then it's a simple matter of people gathering and putting the data together, and then you can oppress people. I had a lady from the Holocaust Museum over a month ago, and she was talking about the oppression in the future may look a lot different than it did in the past, where there was a lot of people killed or imprisoned. In the future, you just may be marginalized in the society. And once they get your face and they associate you with going to church or a mosque or being religious, that they say you can't go into these apartments. You can't buy and sell in this place. You can't travel. Your kids can't go to school because the system has you. And they've got your face and your name, and you're not going to be allowed to participate. And that's probably the face of oppression moving forward in this era, which we don't want to see this happen.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the best of Press Conference USA 2019 on The Voice of America. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. Let's get back to today's Press Conference USA, featuring highlights of the program over the past year. Carol returned to Capitol Hill at the end of June to visit with Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, a Democrat who represents Michigan's 8th Congressional District. Like her colleague, Representative Abigail Spanberger, Congresswoman Slotkin also defeated an incumbent Republican for her seat in Congress. The long-awaited report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller was released in April 2019. The report detailed the outcome of his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Representative Slotkin says the report supports findings by U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia did indeed interfere with the election.
Let's just set the table by saying that in any other time, under a Democrat or Republican president, even before the Mueller report came out, all 17 of the U.S. intelligence agencies came out and said, we believe Russia attempted to meddle in our elections, publicly. In any other presidency, we would have a blue ribbon panel with the greatest minds of a generation from national security and from Silicon Valley worlds coming together with a budget to write a report on how to protect our democracy, because it's that fundamental. Obviously, that hasn't happened. The Mueller report comes out. It reinforces, again, just the full-on attack by the Russians in the form of information warfare that's adapted from Eastern Europe and brought to the United States. So I read the Mueller report, and there is obviously a ton of work going on to try and understand the administration's role and what they did and did not do with the Russians. But there's a whole half of the report that no one is doing, you know, enough talking about, which is on information warfare and how we protect ourselves. There's a group of us looking at this right now. We're members of Congress with a security background or with a law background, and we're all trying to create a suite of legislation that protects ourselves in 2020. Because we can talk about the president's role all we want, and we should, but we're not doing anything to protect ourselves in 2020. So that's where I've been putting my attention, because that's my background. My expertise helps me in that process.
Tariffs have become a key issue of economic concern for the past 2 years. Congresswoman Slotkin gives her views on the use of tariffs, not only to coerce allies like India, the EU, and Canada, but as a tool to change China's egregious unfair trading practices.
I don't think anyone, certainly in my district, feels that China is playing fairly in the international system. China is cheating. China is not being a good international actor when it comes to the issues of trade and currency and intellectual property. But we can't have the cure for that problem be worse than the disease. And I think some of the tariffs that have been imposed, first of all, they create immense instability, particularly for industries in Michigan. And my business owners will tell me, I'm just trying to be able to have a predictable plan for the next year. And with these tariffs and the way the administration is sort of cavalier about threatening them, it is hard for a business owner to have that stability so they can plan. Separate from China, I just can't support the use of some very, very sort of obscure authorities like declaring national security emergencies when it comes to our allies. When it comes to Canada, I'm going to declare, you know, a trade coming from Canada as a national security threat. That's the authority they're using in order to slap some of these tariffs on. I believe in rules and standards. I believe we have to be a country that upholds them. So the way they went about this, I just deeply alienates our allies. And to me, that's always a bad thing, especially when you've got adversaries in the world. So we know that in Michigan, for instance, the supply chain to making cars, we have a ton of industry focused on that, is disproportionately affected our farmers. I mean, I live on a soybean farm. We are disproportionately affected by the tariffs and the trade wars that are going on right now.
July 21st of this year marked the 50th anniversary of NASA's Apollo 11 moon landing, considered one of the greatest accomplishments in human history. We celebrated the occasion with a special science edition of Press Conference USA. NASA chief historian Bill Berry joined me for a discussion on how the space agency was able to meet President John F. Kennedy's challenge of landing a man on the moon and returning safely to Earth before the end of the 1960s. Mr. Berry tells us why he thinks the moon landing is still such a cherished event 50 years later.
Rick, I think the issue is that it's one of the great moments of human history where people have done great steps in exploration. It's like Columbus stepping on a new world or any of the other great explorers from that century. It's the first time humans have set foot on another heavenly body. And I think a lot of people see this as the first step in human exploration of the cosmos in the centuries to come. 500 years from now, who will we remember? Probably not me. But Neil Armstrong, I suspect, will be well on every school kid's lips, just like Christopher Columbus was on mine when I was growing up.
It's incredible. Over the years, you've heard people say, well, they can land a man on the moon, but they can't do this. It's amazing that we're still using that moon landing as a touchstone to greatness. Have we come anywhere near that since?
I hate to think that human accomplishment is so limited that we don't have other great things, but it is a real touchstone because it was seen as such a huge task and such an impossible thing to do, to go from, you know, when President Kennedy made that proposal that we should go to the moon in a decade, we had 15 minutes of experience in space and it was suborbital, right? That was a huge step to, you know, make that challenge. And then, you know, we organized all the forces to make it happen. We had to build a huge infrastructure for NASA and industry, 400,000 people across the planet working in it, 20,000 U.S. companies involved in it. It was huge. And still, we managed to pull it off on schedule, despite expenses and costs and human tragedy as well, with the Apollo 1 crew being lost on the way. But the fact that we pulled it off, I think it really stands out in people's minds. And that's one of the great legacies of Apollo, I think, is this belief that, in fact, humans, when well-organized and focused on a goal, we can do anything.
Mr. Berry looks back at the influence the Cold War between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union played in sending Americans to the moon.
That's a thing that we don't often think about so much these days from a perspective of 50 years. But the whole reason why President Kennedy wanted something to beat the Russians with was because, you know, the Soviet Union was making a case that it was a better system of government than Western capitalist democracy. Mm-hmm. And its proof was, look what we can do in space. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Americans can't even do whatever, you know, this week's, you know, challenge was. The Soviets had a really large booster rocket, and they had a brilliant engineering team. It was very small, but very nimble. And so they were constantly looking for things where they could beat the United States on various things. So a lot of their program wasn't so much a program as a series of sort of propaganda tasks. But it didn't look that way to most everybody on the planet. It looked like the Soviet Union had been destroyed in World War II, and then 12 years later, they're the first country to launch a satellite. A few years later, the first person to put someone in space. It looked like they were way ahead. And Kennedy realized that this was a major political, geopolitical risk for the Western world. You had all these countries that had found their independence after World War II, and they were looking at this, and they weren't particularly keen with the Western model, given their experience with it in the past, a lot of them. And the Soviet system seemed pretty attractive, given its technical capabilities. So there was a lot of concern about where the trend would go. And in 1961, people actually believed that the Soviet system was better than the U.S. system. That was a real serious thing. I mean, nowadays, people kind of roll their eyes and go, go, you got to be kidding me. You know, we know how the Cold War turned out, the Soviet Union falls apart. But at that point, that was a real issue. And one of the successes of Apollo was that we don't even think about that anymore. And in fact, I would argue that beating the Soviet Union to the moon undermined the legitimacy of the Soviet system very effectively, both internally in the Soviet Union and externally. And they became much less of a geopolitical threat during the 70s and 80s. And eventually the Soviet Union collapses, not because we beat them to the moon necessarily, but I think that was one of the things that nudged that system over the edge.
And when and how was it decided that Apollo 11 would be the moon landing mission?
Now that's an interesting question. Often people will think, well, this clear progression. We go to the moon on Apollo 8, we test the lunar module in Earth orbit on Apollo 9, Apollo 10, we test the whole thing around the moon, and then Apollo 11 is obviously going to be the landing. That was not how people at NASA saw it in 1969. They had a series of missions. They were coded to be certain kinds of missions, and it wasn't the mission planned to be the lunar landing mission. But all along the path, as they were training the crews and preparing for those, it was very flexible about which actual launch was going to fit into which category. And so when the spring of 1969 begins, after Apollo 8 successful going to the moon, they name the Apollo 11 crew, and NASA announces in January that Apollo 11 crew may be the first crew to attempt to land on the moon. So we knew that at that point. But if Apollo 9 had gone badly and then the lunar module hadn't been tested properly in Earth orbit, or had been a problem with the lunar module, they would have had to refly that mission again, which meant that that would have been Apollo 10. And so the first lunar landing would be 12 or maybe 13 or 14. So there wasn't hardwired that those things would happen. But we were incredibly good, number one, but also lucky that Apollo 9 went well and Apollo 10 went perfectly well. And so Apollo 11 was our first mission that we might attempt to land on the moon. Actually, turns out to be the mission we attempt to land on the moon. And then it's successful.
The United Nations General Assembly opened its 74th session on September 17th. Carol traveled to New York to talk with former FBI counterterrorism expert Ali Soufan, CEO of the Soufan Group, to discuss major issues emerging from the UNGA, as well as his recent research regarding the growing global threat from white supremacist extremists. Mr. Soufan talked about a report he had written based on research he had conducted regarding that threat.
For a few years, we've been monitoring this new phenomena. And what we do in the center here, we focus on trend lines and we try to predict which trend lines might be fault lines down the future. And that's frankly why we started to monitor what came to be ISIS early on, or the foreign fighters. We were the first entity to collect numbers on foreign fighters, and that wasn't popular. And even in our own government, because the focus at the time back in 2012, 2013 was to just focus on Assad. And later on, the foreign fighters phenomena in Syria developed into being a major contributor to instability in the world. Now we're seeing a new phenomena developing, and it's a white supremacist extremism. And what made us very concerned about it is it's evolving in a similar way to the jihadi threats in the 80s and 90s. So it's a transnational in nature. A lot of people, when we talk about neo-Nazis or white supremacists, they think it's a domestic terrorism issue in the United States. Yes, there is domestic monsters, but they have tentacles in so many different Western countries, all the way from New Zealand to Australia to Ukraine to all the countries in Western Europe to the United States. This network is operating, as I mentioned, in a similar way to the jihadis, but also at the same time, they are copying the jihadis. For example, there is a white supremacist group in the United States. Their name is The Base. The Base mean Al-Qaeda. They copy Al-Qaeda. They actually copy even Al-Qaeda's manuals. They put images of Osama bin Laden. We started to see a movement in promoting the idea of violence to purify Western society from all non-white influences, from Jewish influences, very similar to the jihadis wanted to purify their societies from any un-Islamic influence. So there's a lot of similarities in the way they recruit, in the way they see violence as very justifiable to meet their goals, in the way they fundraise, the way they travel overseas. For example, we always So the jihadis going to conflicts, taking advantage of conflicts in order to build networks, training, experience, to recruit. We've seen them doing it in Afghanistan against the Soviets, and then in the Balkans. We've seen it in Somalia. We've seen it in so many different countries around the world, recently in Syria. And we've seen the same thing happening with the white supremacist extremism. They are using the conflict in the Ukraine in a similar way to how the jihadis used the conflict that I just mentioned to beef their own ranks.
And that's Press Conference USA's look back at 2019. I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very healthy and happy new year. Thanks for listening today, and please join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.